Life is so much more than a diagnosis. It's about sharing time with those you love, hanging with friends who lift you up, and experiencing all those moments that bring you joy. All hits, no skips. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you. So long live singing to the oldies, jamming out to something new, and everything in between.
This is the Good Morning BT Podcast, the best of the week with Bo Thompson and Beth Troutman.
Well, good morning. His music kicks in, and here he is behind.
The music's growing on you after a year, I can tell. You sort of get a little skip in your step in your chair over there.
I have to advance it to the part where it kind of kicks in. It takes a little while.
Is that why we skipped the guitar intro in the beginning for the last 6 months?
I jump around. I'm a Blues Brothers guy.
It's good to be back.
It is. Good to see you. Mick Mulvaney, Bo Thompson, and Beth Troutman in the Ty Boyd studio. And there we were going about our business, Thursday.
Yep.
And I see the story come across the wire that one Mick Mulvaney had been called to Washington to testify in front of the January 6th committee. So I'm thinking about this, and my wheels start turning, and I'm thinking, well, you know, A, he doesn't have to tell me everything, and B, he may not have known about this until last minute. You know, I start thinking a lot of things. But then I thought, you know, I told Beth about this, and she saw the stories too. And then I decided, well, you know what? I'll text him. I'll just text something innocuous like, so, just a quiet day in your world, huh? In fact, that's exactly what I texted him. And the response was, good material for Monday. Which
always thinking about you.
Which was, you know, translation, we'll have a chance to break it all down on Monday. So, Mick Mulvaney, you are sitting in that chair for the first time since you testified in front of the January 6th committee.
Yeah, and a couple things first. I was not called to Washington to testify. I was called to Washington to go watch the congressional baseball game on Thursday night, where the Republicans stomped the Democrats. I believe it was 10-0, our second win in a row. And I couldn't – I played in that game for 6 years, and the Democrats used to have a guy who could throw it in the high 80s. And when you're in your high 40s and you're running against hitting against a guy who's throwing in the high 80s, you have no chance. And he got promoted. He got hired by the Biden administration. Uh-huh. So once you're out of Congress, you can't play anymore. So Cedric had to watch the game, and I had to watch the game. And the guy throwing for the Democrats was throwing lollipops up there. I mean, it was, I wanted to hit against that guy so bad. We won 10-0. So that was why I went to Washington. And it just so happened that there was also a January 6th committee investigation going on at the same time. Yeah, they called me, I don't know, a week, 10 days ago. And said, would you like to come up? Actually, they called my lawyer, and he called me and said, look, I've been contacted by them. It's not going to be under oath, which is interesting, okay, because everybody says, oh, it's not under oath. It's a transcribed interview. It's not a deposition, all of which means absolutely nothing, because as I well know, and everybody knows who sort of does this for a living, you can't lie to Congress anyway. So even though you don't put your hand on the Bible and go, I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, not the truth, so help me God, if you still lie, you're still either going to jail or getting fined or something like that. It's a crime to lie to Congress anyway. So it's sort of something they do on television for the drama to make it look like it's more serious. Really serious, don't get me wrong, but it looks more serious. People put their hands on the Bible and they take the oath. It doesn't make any difference. You're still effectively you're committing perjury if you lie to Congress. So anyway, I didn't lie to Congress. I talked to them for 2.5 hours. We talked today about what they want to talk about and how it came to be. It was talk about the structure for just a little bit, and then we'll get into the content. Structure was interesting. It was five lawyers from the committee. A couple of the members were present on television screens. Mm-hmm. Liz Cheney, Luria were sort of in and out, but 95%, 99% of the questions were asked by the professional staff. I think Liz asked me a couple of questions. That was about it. And it was like being in a deposition. If you're listening to the program, lawyers listening, they know what depositions look like. If you've ever been deposed, you sort of know what it looks like. But it's sort of it's an interview that the plaintiff's lawyers will ask Bo a bunch of questions, then the defendant's lawyers will ask Bo a bunch of questions. I've done 100 of these in my career, right? It was like that, except it was only half of that. So only the folks who didn't like President Trump were there. All of the questions were designed to either try to make him look bad or find stuff to make him look bad. And that's great. I mean, I got no problem with that because I knew it. Not like I didn't know what I was getting into, but I couldn't help but think, all right, if I was a lawyer Or if I was a member of Congress, if I was a staffer representing the other side, here's the follow-up questions I would ask. I had a chance to do some of that myself.
That was my question. Like, how did you respond and bring that other side in?
Yeah, and you could do it. And I'm sitting there going, okay, well, no one's asked me this question, but it's not what you think it is, et cetera, et cetera. So you had to sort of, if the witness isn't there giving the other side of the angles, not saying the other side of the truth, but the additional facts and circumstances that sort of add context, then that will never come out.
So let me ask you, I know you were talking about structure to start to a large degree, but let me get into substance for one second here, because you and I both know, the three of us know, that the way this is designed, they can pick and choose what ultimately gets into one of these hearings or not. So what was one of the follow-up questions that you asked?
No, before we get to that, because you're absolutely right, by picking and choosing, right? I don't trust anybody in Washington. I especially don't trust the media, not you guys, but the corporate media, big, you know, CNN, those types of folks. So we always had a policy when I was in the White House and budget director before that, even when I was in Congress, I always had somebody doing their own tape recording or videotaping, right? So when I was on TV, I had a staffer video recording it so that if they edited it to make it look different, I had the original copy, right?
Well, you had somebody there who was doing that with you?
I asked for permission to do that at the deposition, and they would not let me.
They would not.
And that was a giant, not a red flag, but that was sort of an eye-opener to me. Because if I had been in a civil deposition, I would be entitled to make my own copies. I never did criminal procedure. I understand it's not common, but if you ask, they'll let you do it.
I wonder how many people, other people, if anybody else, has asked to do the same thing.
Yeah, my lawyer said that he asked it, and he didn't get the impression a lot of folks had, but we asked for permission and were specifically denied. I then asked him why, and this was the reasoning he said he got, which is that they didn't want it to become a PR stunt for some of the more outrageous witnesses, and they specifically mentioned Steve Bannon. You can imagine Steve Bannon going in, tape recording the whole thing, and then selling it as a podcast.
So they were trying to not play favorites. So that if they allowed you, they have to allow others.
No, I don't think it's playing favorites as much as they want to control the narrative. They want to control, and they don't want to make it look like it's they won't make it look like what it is, which is a television program.
They
right?
want to be the only editors.
There you go.
Well, they also wouldn't want somebody to profit off of it either. Like if Steve Bannon were to sell it for any measure.
Now, to the part about editing, I have heard, because I asked a question. I can't remember who I asked this of. This was not of the committee, not of my lawyers. It was just I was in Washington for 3 or 4 days, that we are hearing now that the committee, at the end of its work, will provide all of the unedited information.
Transcripts to the American public or just to the Department of Justice?
No, to everybody.
To everybody.
Do you believe that?
Yeah. Why not? At that point, it'll be over. It's sort of like how I feel about bad newspaper reporting. The lies always go on the front page at the top of the banner, and then the corrections always go on page A17 in small print at the bottom, right? So my guess is that's probably what you'll see. They're certainly not going to give the data dump of all of this testimony and all this video the same attention that they gave the stuff on primetime television.
Welcome back on News Talk 1110 WBT. Bo Thompson, Beth Troutman, and former White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. We've had many fascinating conversations in this room with Mick over the last year or so about life in the West Wing and being, 5-6 feet away from the leader of the free world for all those months. And now today, another layer to this, fascinating because we're talking to somebody who just a few days ago was summoned by the January 6th committee. And I don't know when the next committee hearing is going to be. We know that they're likely not going to be any of them in August.
Whoa. There's no chance they're going to do them in August because they're all on vacation.
Okay, so
is really important. Defending democracy is great. Defending, the greatest attack on the Capitol since the War of 1812. This is critically important stuff, but it'll wait till after vacation.
So whenever it does happen, it stands to reason there will be a few more. They've made that clear. They have, and obviously they are still talking to people, i.e. Mick Mulvaney. You sat in front of the committee for how many hours on Thursday?
2.5, not very long.
Okay, and just for people who are just joining us, this set the scene for us. Where was it done and what was it like?
Now, there's an office building near the Capitol. It's one of the various buildings the federal government owns. It's off the beaten path, a nice building. And you're in a conference room with six lawyers and your lawyer and that kind of stuff. Basic stuff, looked like a law firm. So it was not anything noteworthy on that front.
Well, it's pretty fascinating that they called you. Now, you were not subpoenaed. You were just, they asked you to come in, and you said, sure, I'll come in and answer questions. Were you surprised? Were you expecting them to call you?
On the subpoena, that's the type of thing that I pretty much know how it works out.
Yeah.
Because, again, I've been on congressional committees. I've been a member of congressional committees before. And they call you and say, would you like to come in? And the answer is no. Then the subpoena shows up, right? That's how it works. And why spend the money when you know they should get, they're going to get you anyway. So, yeah, they call you and you go down. What was your second question?
Were you surprised? Did you think this was going to happen?
A little bit, Beth, because I was not there. And I did not think that I had firsthand information, which is what I assumed they were interested in. It turns out I was a little bit wrong about that. And we talked more about what they did ask. I knew that I had sent some tweets and a text on January 6th during the riot. But they had that already, and I'm not really sure what I could have added to that. So to a certain extent, yes, I was a little bit surprised to hear they reached out, but it didn't bother me.
So were there things as you started? In our last segment, we were talking about the fact that there really was no cross-examination from other attorneys in that room. So that kind of fell upon you to give information that you knew was necessary but maybe wasn't going to be asked.
It's a great way to put it. Yeah, you could sort of get the feel. By the way, they were all very professional. I mean, they were good lawyers. I'm not saying that these were hack jobs by any stretch of the imagination. They were good lawyers, serious people. The head lawyer, I can't remember his name, but he was the kind of guy like, okay, that guy's a sharp guy.
Yeah.
But you could also tell there was an angle here, and the angle, they're not sitting here. This is not the committee on whether or not they should, you know, give Don Trump the Medal of Honor. I mean, that's not what this is about, right? This is about finding out whether or not Donald Trump committed crimes on January 6th. That's what this whole thing is. So it's slanted in that direction. So when they start to ask you questions about, say, you know, why did I resign? Or, you know, why did I write that Wall Street Journal article? What was I thinking? You know what they were looking for. Mm-hmm. And if you sort of didn't give them what they were looking for, they sort of moved on before you could sort of flesh it out. And then it fall to me to sort of go back and flesh it out.
So can you share with us a little bit about how you talked about that when they asked you why you resigned?
Sure. I mean, without getting it exactly right, because I don't have a transcript for me, I can give you the general sort of conversation. They said they wanted to know if they were implying that maybe I quit because I saw something or I knew something about, you know, criminal activity or really, really, let's say, impeachable offenses. For that's not the word they use. Let's be clear about that. And I'm like, no, listen, I was really unhappy. And I've said this before. I've said it publicly. I've said it 100 times. I did not think at that time that he committed any crimes. I was just really angry with how poorly he had been the president. Mm-hmm. And he was my boss. I mean, I was in the administration. Now, granted, at that time, I'm a sort of a lower level functionary. I'm the special envoy to Northern Ireland. It's not like I'm in the cabinet. So it's not like you can make a big splash. But if you're an employee who works in an organization and you think the organization has done something really, really, really wrong, what's left to you to do but quit? That's what you do, right? It's not like you could march in the boss's office and say X, Y, Z. I couldn't do that. So you just quit. And I said, look, I'd seen 24 of the president's speeches. I'd heard the media talk about how they were going to incite violence in Battle Creek, Michigan, and Minneapolis, and Santa Fe. And we were always going to, everywhere we'd go, the press would say, oh, there's going to be riots because of Donald Trump's incendiary language. And it never happened. Okay? And I thought at the time that the riot was a spontaneous sort of misunderstanding of what the president was doing. Had no idea what the Proud Boys, didn't even know who they were, didn't know any of that. I saw he gave a rally, there was a riot. I didn't see a causal link. So that's not why I quit. I didn't quit because I thought there was a link between the president's actions and the riot. I quit because the president, I thought, failed to rise to the occasion in the 3 hours afterwards, which is an absolutely critical 3 hours in the history of the country. And that's, I don't think that's, it's not necessarily that's what they wanted to hear. It's just that's what they weren't looking for that.
So you said last segment that there were some instances where you became your own cross-examiner, so to speak. In other words, they asked you a question, and then you answered the question, and then gave a little bit of pushback or maybe asked a follow-up question, stuff that you don't think will ultimately end up in the presentation, but you said you would tell us what an example or two of those were.
Well, one was on why I quit. The other one was
the Wall Street Journal article
that I wrote, the op-ed that I wrote about how the president will leave peacefully in a presidential sense. I wrote that, I think, a week or two after the election. And they said, you know, were you worried that he wasn't, you know, going to leave? And I'm like, look, I was never, never, ever thought there'd be violence. Okay? That never even crossed my mind. And I think I can make the case it didn't cross anybody else's mind. If violence had crossed Nancy Pelosi's mind, she would have increased the security that day. So I don't think I'm breaking new ground when I say, look, everybody says it's easy in hindsight to go back and look, oh, there was going to be violence. You knew it. Everybody knew it. No, they didn't, because if it was that easy to see, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrat leadership in the House would have seen it at the time. So, no, that was not why I wrote the piece. I wrote the piece primarily because I know how the president thinks. And this is where I started to push back on them a little bit. I said, I know how the president consumes information. I wasn't able at that time to pick up the phone and call the president. I wasn't able at that time to call the phone and pick up Mark Meadows. It's not a former chief of staff had never reached out to me proactively. They would take my calls, but they would never stick their nose in where it wasn't belong. So it's not protocol, but it's tradition. Once you're the ex-chief of staff, you sort of stay out until they ask you to come back in. But I knew how he got information, and he reads every single day the op-ed page in the Wall Street Journal. And now, so that was a audience of one piece, which is, Mr. President, as your former chief of staff, I'm here to remind you, not only have I seen you be presidential in the past, it's really, really important for your legacy that you be presidential now on your way out. And I was talking about, they said, well, were you worried about violence? And I said, no, I was worried about him taking all the W's off the keyboards like the Clinton team did when George W. Bush ran in 2000. I was worried about that Bush League stuff that could tarnish a reputation on the way out of office.
So,
wow. I've read that op-ed piece over and over again, and I know that it gets pushed back at you often on Twitter. People are pretty consistently bring that article back up, given what happened on January 6th. But how fascinating to know that you wrote it because you knew that President Trump was going to read it. I don't know that I've ever heard that.
You should have seen the look on the lawyers' faces when I used Clinton as the example of what I did want to have happen.
Welcome back, Bo Thompson, Beth Troutman, and in the Ty Boyd studio right across from us is Mick Mulvaney, former White House Chief of Staff, former South Carolina Congressman, White House Budget Director, and the most recent person to testify, I believe. No one's happened.
They could have had additional witnesses on Friday, but yeah, I did
that. We
Thursday.
Don't know about.
I did Thursday afternoon.
Okay, well,
close enough.
Very, very possibly the most recent person to testify.
Highly unlikely. They work weekends.
So I got to ask you. You talked about some of the follow-up questions where you push back a little bit, and you think it probably will be left on the cutting room floor of what they present to. The American people next time they appear in front of the American people, the January 6th committee. You were there on Thursday in D.C. Are there parts of you said 2 hours of testimony?
Yeah, 2.5.
Are there parts of that that you know or you have a good feeling will be included?
Yeah, I thought the most interesting, there's a couple interesting pieces that they came up. And I'm like, okay, as they presented me with what they had, I'm like, this is why I'm here. I'm about it. And one was a text that I sent. A couple of days after the election, and they showed it to me and said, is this your text? And I'm like, yeah, that is absolutely my text. And I thought the first reaction I had was they didn't get this from me because they'd asked me to go through my phone, and I went through my phone with my lawyer, and we looked for stuff and couldn't find anything that was responsive to what they asked for. So they had this text, and it was date-stamped or whatever. So clearly they got this from somebody else, and it's a text that I had sent to Ronna McDaniel, Tommy, I can't remember Tommy's last name, Jared Kushner, Bill Stepien, and Justin Clark. And that was we did about 25 minutes on that text and the stuff that went around it.
Okay, so you sent this, a screenshot of that text, to Beth and to me over the weekend. And I'm going to read it right here, with your permission. Here we go. It says, I'm getting this sinking feeling that everyone other than me thinks we've lost this election. I'm out here telling everybody we haven't. If people know something I do not, I would appreciate it if you would let me know. It is better for me not to do TV and to keep my mouth shut than to do TV and say we have a chance when the people in the know that we do not.
Yeah, so you can imagine why that got their attention. Because clearly something had happened, or they asked me, why did you write the text? So here's the story behind the text and the story that follows the text, which is, and I can't remember exactly the batting order, and I told them that. But at some point, I'd been on, starting on election night, we were all sort of deeply involved with it. Again, I was the national chairman of Catholics for Trump, so I was involved with the campaign to a certain extent, watching the election very closely, probably not a surprise. And Arizona was a really, really close race. And I know a little bit about Arizona. I've got friends there, and it was a really tight race. So over the course of that night and into the next couple of days, I spent most of my time watching Arizona. I was getting information off the website. I was talking to local politicians trying to figure out, could Trump close the gap? Arizona, for example, is one of those rare states, I think, that the voting from the day of election get counted last. And those tend to skew more Republican. So it turns into a math problem. We've got 15,000 votes to make up. There's X number of votes remaining outstanding. We have to get 75% of those votes. And if we do, he wins, et cetera. So it's a back and forth. And I was tweeting about that at the time and doing some media on that issue. And at some point, I was on a call with Ronna McDaniel from the RNC, and she casually said, and we've lost Arizona. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, that's the first I've heard of that. And that's what prompted the text. And then at some point after that, I also was on a phone call with what they call a surrogate phone call. So all the people that are sending out on television, go out on TV and say, here's the talking points from the committee. We do it. The Democrats do it. Every time you see Dan Bongino on TV, he's probably got talking points from the campaign. So did I. Right. And they said, look, tune in to the surrogate phone call this afternoon, and we'll give you all the information you need to keep going out there and defending the president and, you know, defending the election results. Okay. And I remember getting off the call and going, they got nothing. They got absolutely nothing. It was a joke. And I think that the exact words I used to the committee were, a child could tell that they were making stuff up at this point. And so I called Stepien and Clark afterwards directly, and I said, what the hell was that? And I got this response like, well, hey, Mick, thanks a lot for being a great team player. And that was the last conversation I remember having with anybody on the campaign. So that, my guess, is one of the things that they will use if they try and layer more. I don't think they need any more evidence that the president knew or should have known that he lost the election. But if they decide they want to sort of pile on, that will be additional testimony that they will use to make it look like not only did the president should have known he lost the election because there were people on his team who knew at that point that he'd lost the election.
Did that lead them down a line of questioning from, like, him knowing that his team knew to the procedure of how the MyPillow guy and Susan Powell and everybody kind of got access to the president in those days?
It did not lead to that, but that did come up. So there were three lines of questioning, one on January 6th, one around the election, and then one on the functioning of a West Wing. How do people get in? What's the process? How hard is it as a chief of staff to keep people out? How did you run it? So the answer is yes and no. So it did not lead from the discussion about the text, but that discussion did happen independently of the text.
Is that something that you think will also end up on a hearing, or is there something else that was really important that you think might end up on one of these broadcast hearings that we see?
That might end up on there because, you know, I've been very candid about this. I've said this on this program many times that, you know, at the beginning of Trump's administration, he was being advised by the former president of Goldman Sachs and the former CEO of ExxonMobil. At the end of the administration, he was being advised by a guy who sells pillows and a trade advisor who makes up his academic sources. Peter Navarro got caught fabricating an imaginary friend in his academic work. So we did talk about that and how that might happen. I didn't know how it happened because I wasn't on the inside. So I think they were looking for background information should they ever get a chance to talk to Mark Meadows. Mark, how did you control the flow of information into the White House? So that was, I think they were honestly just looking for sort of structural insight into how a West Wing might run.
The Best of the Week with Bo Thompson and Beth Troutman. Good Morning PT.
What to do with Eastland Mall? I feel like I've asked this question before.
Yeah.
That's because I have. This comes up every few years, ever since the demise of Eastland Mall in its heyday. And yesterday, Charlotte city leaders breaking ground on this new project, which was dubbed Eastland Yards. I can't get...
Like Camden Yards?
That's exactly what George said and what
really?
I said. Like you say yards.
Oriole Park, what do we do here?
That's right.
The Pigeon Park.
One of the shovelers yesterday was Cal Ripken.
Boog Powell.
But yeah, so Eastland Yards, so as I understand it, when they presented this new logo yesterday. Did you see the logo?
Mm-hmm.
It's not the most sophisticated logo I've ever seen, have to admit. But I thought to myself... Eastland Yards. And then I heard some chatter about the fact that apparently someone owns the Eastland Mall and more importantly, the Eastland logo that we all remember, the little sunshine deal. That was,
oh, yeah. I was trying to think what it was.
So somebody owns that. And so because of that, they can't use it. And I'm thinking to myself, I mean, I'm not a copyright lawyer or anything like that, but maybe we can talk to Bill Graham about this later. But if you went to the trouble to own the old Eastland logo, I would think you would be one of the people that want to bring the old logo back.
Yeah, I'd be selling right. That copyright and say, bring that sunshine back. I mean, the literal drawing.
Doesn't
of the sunshine.
Raisin Bran own that sunshine?
This one
the
had
cereal box?
No. So this one had The Raisin Bran guy has straight rays. The Eastland Mall guy logo, he had squiggly rays. Do you remember this? It was like squiggly S's coming off of the sun.
Well, they should like do some like slight variants and call it their own.
Yeah.
Nobody owns the sun.
Right.
It belongs to all of us.
Does anybody own the two scoops?
Oh, I'm sure.
I'm sure the Raisin
Bran. I'm sure Kellogg got on top of that years ago.
Or maybe that guy, that one guy that owns the logo.
So yeah. Jim,
or is that Post? I guess Raisin Bran's Post, isn't it?
It is Post. Good recall.
Yeah, sorry.
You used to live on the east side.
When I first lived here, when I first was alive, when I first moved here, I lived, as I put it all together, down Albemarle and Farm Pond. There was an apartment complex behind what was at first a Kroger or a Bilo. I forget whatever. I think it was Kroger first became a Bilo. Anyways, and there was a dollar like movie theater that was right there. So mm-hmm. I lived right there. So truly, I was probably about less than 2 miles, maybe a mile and a half away from Eastland Mall when I first lived here for the first 2 years.
And did you go there a lot?
Yeah, because I didn't have any money. I was 22 years old. And they had the ice skating rink there. And I was, you know, buying books back then when people bought books. We go to the bookstore.
At a bookstore?
Yeah.
Because Beth and I were talking about, you know, what was it about Eastland that made it what it was? And it was, to me, I mean, everybody thinks about the ice skating rink, and then you think about the movie theater, and you think about the food court stuff, and I can think about individual places, but I think the whole key was it was the first place I'd ever seen that had all that in one.
Yeah.
First place I'd ever seen that was a double-decker, like a two-level mall.
Mm-hmm. And it was like three levels if you counted the ice skating rink.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
You went to that center.
Exactly. And there, if you go online on the Eastland, you know, nostalgia sites, and they exist, you know, Old Charlotte and Old Eastland even, they always show that center shot where you can see the ice skating rink, then you see the two balconies, mm-hmm. and it just looks like this big fortress. And back in those days, it was, but then along came Concord Mills, and along came
South Park.
But what's the one in Pinelon? Carolina Place.
Which 485 didn't exist. Do you guys remember when Carolina Place opened? And if you lived, I mean, I lived in Concord. I went on a date, quote unquote date, with a guy in high school, and we drove like an hour and a half to get to Carolina Place Mall because it was back roads. You didn't have 485 there to get to it.
So Carolina Place, Concord Mills, North Lake, you know, the two-level malls are not a novelty anymore. But back then, that place was like a hub
of
stuff.
It was so cool.
And I was talking to Beth before we came back from the break. You know, if there's anything in Charlotte to compare in modern times to what Eastland felt like, ironically, it's also shut down for mm-hmm. the most part. It feels, if you go walk through the epicenter right now, it feels like Eastland did in its dying days. And you think about the epicenter, what was unique about the epicenter? It had not only a bowling alley, it had a movie theater, it had several bars, it even had a hotel on the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this was in one place. Mm-hmm. So it's this novelty of being able to go somewhere where, sure, you can have all these experiences by themselves, but where have you ever been able to kind of combine it all into one? And to me, that's I guess it sort of almost answers the question. Those places are hard to keep afloat because they're unusual, and it's not the norm to have this big facility that can do all of this. But in the heyday of both, you know, that's where everybody wanted to be.
Yes, especially young people. I mean, I remember being in middle school, even just would drop – my parents would just drop us off, a group of us, and we would walk around. We'd get an Orange Julius. We'd maybe ice skate. We'd eat at Annabelle's. You'd shop at – Structure and the Express, you know, all of the places that were the cool places to shop. I don't know if what they have in mind now is going to be a hub like that was for our generation. Is it going to revitalize an area that, quite frankly, is so different, so different from what it was for us 20 years ago? I hope that it does. I hope that it does and brings that back to the vibrant area of the city that it could be, but I don't know the answer. And I'm wondering if the 20 acres, what we do with that 20 acres that right now, that because of Tepper pulling out, if that, whatever that thing becomes, might be the anchor of it.
I feel like it kind of has to be. I mean, whatever it is, it was going to be the Charlotte FC headquarters, which would be a unique thing. And look how hot that is right now.
Yeah.
So if that were ever to resurface, then maybe you got something. But I think the whole point is, I mean, we make fun of the movie studio that they were going to do. And there was one point in time.
I kind of liked that idea.
Well, and they even one time were talking about putting some sort of, I still don't know how it would work, but it was like a ski ramp, like a ski jump. But
like an indoor ski thing.
But it has to be something. something that you can't do anywhere else because mm-hmm. it's the pull has got to be so much that you sort of put aside some of the other things that would turn you away to get you there. And if it's not Charlotte FC, because I'm trying to think of what the—and that's essentially the question now.
Well, I did the interrupting thing, which I always complain about other people doing. So, like, in Rock Hill, they have that—what's that, the roller dome, whatever that thing's called down there with, like, you know, the skateboard parks and all that.
Yeah,
the bikes and all that stuff. You know, something more like that with the BMX bikes or something where it's like— in Charlotte, where you have something that a big skate park or bike park or whatever thing like that, but I don't think in Charlotte have something like
an indoor whitewater center with like a rock climbing wall, maybe a skating rink. I want a skating rink with a big old mirror ball.
Maybe that's the key. Maybe you just either you move the Whitewater Center to Eastland or you move Eastland to the Whitewater Center. Because seriously, the Whitewater Center is one of those type places.
Uh-huh.
Like it's unique in the country.
It's a destination.
So
we connect them with a river. So you can go from one to the other and just kayak.
Uh-huh.
Good Morning BT, the weekly podcast.
We have somebody on the line right now I want to bring on who's been patiently waiting. Neil, you're on News Talk 1110 WBT. You know of Eastland and its earliest days, don't you?
Good morning. Yes, I helped open the store.
Wow.
I was a manager of a shoe store. I was also on the board. I also met my wife out there.
Oh.
And it's an interesting story. She came in with her four-year-old daughter, and she was a widow, and I helped them try to get shoes for patent leather, but I was kind of busy, so another person helped her, and that was on an opening day. Then a couple of days later, she came in, and I sold her Papagallos at 7B, and then she came in a couple of days later, and she bought Agnew's, a person, shoes, and then Saturday, her sister came in, and I sold her some nursing shoes, and she dropped Ellen's name several times, and then Monday I saw her walking through, and we had a big store, so I probably ran about 25 yards, and I got out in front of the middle of the walkway and said, "What you doing Saturday night?" She says, "Nothing." She says, "Good, you're going out with me."
Aww.
Okay. So then we talked all week long, probably 3 or 4 hours, and I knew, okay, I think this is the one, but you know, then we went out to eat. You know those triangle games where you have that one tee? You know, left.
Mm-hmm.
I had that one tee left, never been able to do it since. I said, okay, she's the one. So at 7:30, I asked her, you know, "I love you." "Well, I like you too. Let's slow down." At 9:30, I said, "Will you marry me?" She says, "Well, I love you too." At 10 o'clock, she said yes.
Oh, look at you.
And all of this happened at Eastland Mall.
At Eastland Mall, in a week. We were married for 36 years, bless your soul. And, we'd come in and eat and so forth. The four-year-old and kids was ice skate. And so basically about 3 or 4 years, that was our spot, you know, of a family and everything else.
Yeah, and don't you miss it? There's not a place like that quite like it in Charlotte now where families can go and there are that many activities to be a part of.
No, and one of the the concerns we had as we opened up, we saw, I said, "What are you going to do about security?"
Mm-hmm.
And that was our always, as merchants, it was pretty high traffic. Let's face it, there was really nothing on that side of town. Things were kind of hopping. So, you know, and of course, I got out of retail and got into banking. But it was, at the beginning, that place was hopping. You could do everything. You could eat, go to the movies, ice skate. I mean, it was just fantastic. It really was.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Neil, did you hear or watch any of this yesterday, the new proposal?
Yes, I did. So, I hope it does well. I mean, I remember I saw it being torn down. It's been a big empty piece of land. And you never know. You have to try something.
Yeah.
You know, and this developer's going to really try it. We've had a lot of people talk about it. Looks like he's going to do it. And who knows? That area needs to be vitalized. It does. I mean, it's a high crime area now.
Yeah.
And it's. I think something needs to be done. I mean, I live in Mooresville now, but it's... I think it's an attempt, and I think it's going to work.
Well, that's important, though. That's kind of what I'm getting at, is you were there in 75 when it all opened. You were there for its heyday. Lots of people are new to the area and don't really understand what Eastland was, but you know it as well as anybody, and you believe this has got a shot.
Yes, and I think if everybody would be positive about it and it's promoted well, and basically, let's face it, housing and so forth, looks like they're trying to get low-income housing too, I think it gives people a shot.
Look at Neil. I like him. He's like, be positive. You're my kind of guy, Neil. I've never met a Neil, and this is the honest to God's truth. I've never met a Neil that I didn't like.
Well, I appreciate that. Also, I guess a little sidebar. I'm a widow, and I live by myself now, but listening to you guys talk, it's like, hey, I have a family every morning to talk to, and it's really nice. I do appreciate your show.
Oh, thanks so much, Neil. That's a huge compliment. We so appreciate that.
Yeah, all right.
Neil.
Again, yes, sir.
I just want to say thank you. I appreciate you calling, and your perspective is especially important on mornings like this, and the fact that you think this may have a shot means something to me.
Well, you know, we have to try. You guys have a positive radio show. We've got to be positive. Everything now is so negative. It's just getting so lousy. I mean, let's just be positive for a change and do something.
Well, thank you for calling. I appreciate it.
You have a good day now.
You too. That's Neil, who helped open Eastland back in 1975.
And I like it. Let's be positive. Get those food trucks out to Eastland. Eastland, what is it, Yard? Yards.
Eastland Yards. I should have forgot to ask him if he liked that name.
Or the Eastland logo that I just realized was a sunshine, but I thought was a compass.
And then Neil called in, and I went straight to him, and I didn't tell you the thing I think they should do.
Oh, what's the
thing? I will tell you that when we come back here on News Talk 1110 WBT. Well, good morning to everybody. News Talk 1110 WBT. We appreciate Neil calling in our last segment.
I love Neil.
Neil. Beth loves all Neils.
I do. I've never met a Neil I do not like.
You know Neil.
You know Neil.
Is there a name of a person that you immediately know you don't like?
Oh, I can't. I can't think of one off the top of my head. Let me dig deep into my brain. I'll come back to you.
So Neil called, and I was intending on telling you all my big idea for Eastland Mall. But then Neil called, and Neil was on the planning board and met his wife at Eastland and had a shop at Eastland. So I thought, we got to put him to the front of the pack. And I enjoyed that conversation. But I said at one point last hour, I have an idea. And this is that idea. Why not go back to the thing that made Eastland the cool, unusual place in the beginning? Why not build the biggest ice skating rink anywhere in North Carolina, put it at Eastland? In other words, so double down on the thing that people think about. Make that not only the place, you know, we're talking about Charlotte FC, still pursue that and try to get the soccer hub there, but why not involve the Charlotte Checkers? And why not make it a hockey facility? Why not, like, everybody thinks of Eastland. What was the most unusual thing about Eastland? It was the ice skating rink.
And I loved that ice skating rink. You know what? Bo Thompson, I love that idea. I was wondering when you played the Snoopy stuff, what was happening. Well, I thought you were going to say, like, put a piano bar in.
I'm picturing Matt DuBois doing a Forrest Gump run down the road about this.
Well, I think of Matt DuBois because, you know, that could be like, who knows? That could be where Holiday on Ice is. Huge.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Four times the size of what it used to be. I'm just thinking big here, but if you're going to think, I mean, if you're going to make Eastland return to what Eastland was, then why not tap into what made Eastland cool in the first place? And I mean cool. As in cold. The ice skating rink. And all this stuff they talked about yesterday can all still be there, and you can still pursue soccer, but what if it became not just a soccer hub, but a hockey hub and an ice skating hub? And, you know, we talk about the Whitewater Center. Make Charlotte a destination where ice skaters want to go. Because right now, if you ice skate or you play hockey, you have to go to the one in Indian Land, don't you?
I was about to say, where in the heck
it's Indian
do
Land's
you
got
ice skate?
Down the road in
Indian
Land.
And every time I hear somebody say that, I think, well, that's fine and good, but, you know, you got to go there to do this. You can't do that in Charlotte anymore. You used to be able to because the ice capades, and there was even hockey practice at the old Eastland rink, if I remember correctly.
Well, and they taught figure skaters there because if you remember, if you hung over, I loved this as a kid, if you hung over the railing, you could watch teachers and young girls in their, like, performance leotards with the little skirts learning how to do all the figure eights and the swirls and the twirls, and then when the ice skating rink opened up, you'd go down there and you'd try all those yourself, and then you'd break your leg. And I'm not speaking from experience.
Well, that kind of ended on a sour note there.
Yes.
Because you try to do all the things that no one taught you.
Everyone had all this energy, and then you break your leg.
But we mentioned the Whitewater Center last hour, and the thing about the Whitewater Center that is so cool, because I said, what's the one place in Charlotte that you could move there, and that would give it instant sort of cachet? I mean, the Whitewater Center. Uh-huh. I'm not saying they're going to do that, but I'm saying the Whitewater Center is unusual, and it's a draw because it's – it's unique in the country. It's where they go practice and have the trials for the whitewater competition in the
right.
Olympics.
A lot of the Olympic contestants trained at the Whitewater Center. So imagine if we had winter Olympic trainers at our ice skating facility.
Or you had winter and summer in the same town. In other words, Charlotte becomes like this Olympic destination for people who want to be Olympians or like the Olympics, because you have the Whitewater Training Center, which is obviously Summer Olympics, and then make the Eastland site a big Winter Olympic type training place, an ice skating rink where you go play hockey, where you go play, or you go learn how to ice. I mean, you know, you got to make it. It's got to be something unusual. And if there's one thing that if you go out on the street and you talk to Charlottians who are here at the time who knew something about Eastland and all the people that were there today, what's the first thing you think of when you think Eastland?
Nine
out of 10 of them, maybe 10 out of 10, are going to say the ice skating rink.
Mm-hmm. Because it was the central focus of that whole place. And ice skating there was so, so much fun. If you had like a big rink with bleachers and stuff where you could watch the Checkers play, and then a smaller rink where with like a glass window where you could watch the Checkers train, but you could also be ice skating and mm-hmm. make you feel. I mean, that's all about goal setting, right? You have kids who are watching these people do something that's professional. And I like it, Bo Thompson.
Well,
food trucks, you need food trucks there too, or like a food court.
That's the great thing about all this. There you go. Recreate the food court like it used to be.
And then we put some shops around it, and we'll call it Eastland Mall.
That's right. See, it's all right there. Like, you don't even
have to. That's a great place for a mall.
And you know what? The one thing we're forgetting.
All the infrastructure's there.
Put a movie theater there too.
What? Yep. And a bookstore?
Yes. I mean, and if you
Orange Julius?
yum.
I think we solved the problem.
There
all right.
You go.
Next issue, Ukraine and Russia.
The best of Bo and Beth. This is Good Morning BT.
News Talk 1110 WBT. Bo Thompson and Beth Troutman here on a Thursday morning, and we're going to go direct, because we can, to Ukraine, the capital city of Kyiv, which is where Brett Jensen is right now. Can you hear my voice all the way over here in the States?
Loud and clear, Bo. Is everything good on your end in terms of my voice?
I can hear you. It's going a little in and out, so we'll just have to kind of see where this goes. But how you doing, my friend?
We're good. If I need to do by phone, let me know. But yeah, everything's good. Out and about today, walking around. And so far, we just had a little rain shower, but everything's good. And walking around in St. Michael's Golden Dome Cathedral area, which is one of the more prominent and famous places in all of Kyiv, I just came across a university student, and he's 19, and his name is Alexander. And Alexander, give you a little bit of background. He and his family fled
Brett.
To the very...
I'm afraid we're going to have to do it by phone. This is kind of, it's going in and out on me. I want to hear what he has to say, but I'm going to have Bernie call you real quick. Is that okay?
I can hear you. I hope this is better.
That's great.
That's loud and clear. So as you were, sorry for interrupting.
Okay, so I'm at St. Michael's Golden Dome, and it's one of the more famous places in all of Kyiv. And you see it constantly on TV cameras when newscasters are doing their broadcasts. It's usually a backdrop. And so while I'm here, just checking out the same place I was last year, I grabbed Alexander. And Alexander is a university student. He's 19 years old, and he and his family fled to the most western parts of Ukraine, where there's basically no action has happened since the early part. But he's also been volunteering and helping out with the war efforts. So what Alexander's been doing is he takes a lot of the stuff that's being donated from the West, Western Europe, North America, and helps sort it. So he'll go, okay, this is the medicine pile. These are the clothes pile. This is the weapons pile. And he helps doing all that. And so I grabbed Alexander, basically kidnapped him. And so he's standing right here next to me. So Alexander, what's life been like in Kyiv these last couple of months?
In Kyiv? I think it was a lot of people was a little bit like nervous. They was trying to keep their lives, like to just to live their common life. So like this.
What about you? Do you ever get scared with, because the missiles are still coming? The missiles are still coming into Kyiv. When they come, do you go to bomb shelters? What do you do?
Oh, in my building, we don't have a bomb shelter. We just have like a metro station in 10 minutes to walk to it. So I just stay in my flat when it's air alert or something like this. I just try to have the two walls. If something will, how to say, to bomb, yes, something will bomb. So if the glass will be broken, I have just one more wall. So it keeps me. But if something like rocket will just launch in my flat, yes, of course, it's a little bit risky.
You know, you're a college student in here in the heart of Kyiv. Has it been normal, the same amount of students, the same number of students, less students? What's that like going to school here full time?
Oh, because of coronavirus, we had like online all these years. So, and we just had also online during the war. When the war started in the 24th February, like for probably 1 month, we didn't have any studies because everyone was trying just to save themselves, to save their parents, and like this. A lot of my friends, they are not just in Ukraine. They're in different countries, in different towns all around the world. And it feels a little bit strange, but okay, it's the new reality.
Guys, do you have anything you want me to ask Alexander?
Yeah, I would love to know where does he find the courage to stay in Kyiv and to stay in Ukraine? What keeps him there despite the violence that he's seen and that he's witnessed and that he's felt even being in his flat there?
They would like to know, why did you and your family decide to stay in Ukraine? And you're here in Kyiv, where it's more dangerous than in the West. So why did you your family stay in Ukraine and not leave like many of your friends?
So just right now, there are no tanks or something like this near the Kyiv. Yes, it was like some horrible things like Bucha and Irpin. But now, yes, it's rockets are flying, but we need to live our lives, to donate to our army, to work for economic, for myself, it's like to study and to grow up like a good specialist in Ukraine and to make my country great again, like this.
Guys?
Wow. That's pretty remarkable that he's saying that he needs to be in that area to help maintain his nation. Like, that's a level of courage that we haven't had to experience in our generation.
Bo Thompson and Beth Troutman, we're following the travel itinerary of Brett Jensen, who is overseas, to say the least. He is actually in the Ukraine today, in Ukraine, in the capital city. And if you've been following along, we talked to him about 24 hours ago, Beth Troutman, and he was en route from Lviv to Ukraine on a bus.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's there. And in fact, he FaceTimed me. There I am sitting in my, you know, basement, and I'm FaceTiming with Brett Jensen, who is in his Airbnb in the town square there. I mean, really, like, essentially, you were describing it to me, Jensen, it's like Times Square, that version of the same thing in Kyiv.
Yeah, it's called Independence Square, and there's a great thing on Netflix right now about Ukraine and how these, yes, everyone knows that they broke away from the Soviet Union as part of the Soviet bloc, you know, 1991. But in 2014, there was a revolution here in Ukraine, and specifically Kyiv, where they broke away because it was a puppet government, just like what Belarus is with Russia. And so they got rid and kicked and overthrew the government so they could actually have a democracy and not a puppet government of Moscow. And the big uprising took place. One of the big protests and all the protests, whenever there's protests, is called Independence Square. And that's what I'm overlooking. The Airbnb that I have directly overlooks it. And if you go to Netflix and just search Ukraine War, you can see this great documentary that had about it, that it how basically students, it was students that led the uprising in Ukraine back in 2014.
I mean, we take so much for granted here, you know, in this country. And when you travel to places like Ukraine, and certainly with what they're going through now, but knowing how desperate and passionate they were about a new government, about maintaining their freedoms, and now here they are under attack because of Vladimir Putin. Talk to us about what it feels like in the city for you to be in this space that we've seen so many dramatic images coming from on our, you know, media outlets here. But when you're there, I'm sure it's a completely different feeling. Like, you might have one building that's standing tall, one building that has been bombed or been attacked. Is there a feeling amongst the people? Is there kind of a constant nervousness? Do you feel fear? What is it like to be a person in that city, in that place?
You know, coming in, Beth, that bus ride wound up taking about almost exactly to the minute 21 hours from Krakow, Poland, into Kyiv yesterday. And, you know, and when I spoke to you guys yesterday morning, 24 hours ago, you know, it was just countryside. You'd see some army people walking, you'd have to go through some barricades every now and then. But then as you start getting closer to Kyiv, because it's a good 6-hour drive. It's like driving from D.C. to Charlotte, and that's how far it was. And so as you start getting towards, let's just, again, I'll use North Carolina geography, as you start getting like Greensboro, when you're Greensboro away from Charlotte, and then you start getting towards High Point and Salisbury, the damage really escalated big time and just bombed out, apartment buildings, warehouses, these massive things just completely leveled. And you can all barely see a frame there. And then when you get into Kyiv itself, you can look at some of the high-rise buildings. And some of the high-rise buildings, mostly apartments, have a lot of a high-rise and very high-end, because the black market is very big in Kyiv. And so the black market and some of the, you know, Ukrainian mafia is very big here in Kyiv. And so a lot of those really, really high-end apartment buildings are just destroyed, and they're trying to rebuild them as best they can.
Wow.
In terms of, like, you walk around, and I was trying to figure out the best way to describe this. When you walk around, and it doesn't matter, you could just be on a random side street, or you can be anywhere on Independence Square where I'm at. The things that you saw, the big metal structures that were sitting on the beach in Normandy during that invasion where the U.S. came ashore, and you saw all those metal beams. They almost look like jacks from, like, when we were kids, when you bounce the ball and you pick up jacks. The steel girders that are like jacks, they're everywhere. And sandbags are everywhere. I mean, just on the corners in case people need them. There are sandbags and massive concrete barricades on every single bridge, on each side of the bridge, to either defend it or blow it up if they have to, so the Russians can't cross it. And just 2 days ago, one of the biggest announcements came out of the government here was that they blew up a massive bridge. Ukraine blew up its own bridge because there's only two bridges that Russia can use to get where it wanted to go, and they blew up one of the bridges. So now they have to tunnel. The Russian forces have to tunnel on one bridge and just makes them sitting ducks. And so, you can believe me, you can definitely see it. As a matter of fact, I mean, I'm not joking when I say I'm 15 feet from a captured and bombed out Soviet tank, or Russian tank, although it was probably built during the Soviet Union. But you definitely see this. You know you're in a war zone because there's army everywhere.
Well, and two things. So, A, I saw that picture that you're standing in front of, and I was saying to the folks here in the room, I said, you know, if you're looking at that, it would look like maybe Brett's, you know, at a museum site somewhere in America. And it's a tank, and it's a real tank, but the difference is that tank was recently an active tank and is there because shortly ago it was taking part in war efforts there. So, and then the other part of that is, You're still pulling off the pink shirt and shorts there in the middle of Kyiv.
Actually, Bo, it's bad lighting. It's pure white. It's white shirt and khaki shorts.
Okay.
It's the lighting.
But yeah, still,
no, Bo, you would fit in perfectly because the only thing they wear in Eastern Ukraine is blue, black, and gray. So it'd be awesome.
So I would blend in, yet you don't.
To put it mildly, yes.
Yes.
The best of Bo and Beth. This is Good Morning BT.
You know what that is?
No, it sounds like that's a terrifying siren.
That's a siren that woke Brett Jensen up in the middle of the night.
Oh, isn't that haunting?
He actually sent me the audio of this, and he joins us right now, Brett Jensen, direct from Kyiv, Ukraine. And I saw you tweet about this last night, the fact that, and I was asking you yesterday, and you said, at some point we'll probably hear the sirens, but you had not yet then. Well, now you have, right?
Yeah, 1:55 in the morning, I was, nice, sound asleep, and I was like, what is that noise? And then, because, it takes you a minute to figure out what the heck's going on if I'm asleep. And I woke up and went, oh my goodness, that's the siren. Well, then I immediately just tried to get dressed as quickly as I could, put on my shoes. And by the time, I got out there and got onto the pavement, because I'm four stories up, you heard the last moments of it. And I was able to capture the last moments of that siren as I was going to the subway station. And so, yeah, it was a little hairy. I mean, it was the first real time, and I know you've seen I see the bombed out people, and I see the bombed out buildings, and I speak to, I've spoken to, army people and everyone else and citizens, but it was the first time where it really hits you, where you go, okay, you're in a war zone. And that was the first time that it really hit me last night.
So as this siren is waking you up, I'm sure as your brain is, coming out of the sleep fog, I'm sure your heart was racing. As you must have raced downstairs, right? And then gone, did you head across the square? I know you said you were about 100 yards where you were staying from the subway metro area, which you said everyone is using as a bomb shelter. Were there a lot of people going with you toward the subway? What was the feeling? What did it feel like in that square surrounded by people? Or maybe you were alone and no one was running.
Well, and it's more of the latter. I was, I got down there and I took the elevator down.
Oh, you took the elevator. You didn't take the stairs.
No, because the elevator is much, much faster. Like, this elevator is like the speed of lightning. It's this elevator is like an old Soviet building that I'm in. And so this elevator's got to be 50, 60, 70 years old. I mean, it is a very old elevator. But
well, I got to assume you're not waiting in line to use it either.
Yeah, I hope not.
Well, exactly. And so I got there, and it was the fastest way to get out. And so that's what I did. And I went towards in a very brisk, fast walk, went to the subway station about 100 yards away or so. And very, very few people were out in the square going to it. And now, granted, it's maybe because there aren't a lot of apartments or condos where I'm at. But I got to the subway station, and there were like 10 people there, like down at the bottom. And I was just sitting there thinking to myself, where's everyone at? And then the sirens went off, quit doing it, because you can hear them in other parts of the city. And everyone got up and started walking out like it was no big deal. And I just started following them. And I went back to the apartment, and I was back inside my apartment. Alarm, I went off, like I said, about 1:55, and I was back in my apartment by 2:20, 2:15. And so it was, and I went around, and I've met with a lot of people this morning, and I asked them about that. I said, do you go to the shelters? And they said, no. Would they, especially at that time of night, especially when it's in curfew hours, they just stay inside their apartment.
Wow. And, isn't it remarkable how the human body, I don't know if this is the right terminology, but quickly adjusts to stress, quickly adjusts to a new normal, because this is now, for the folks in Kyiv, it's their new normal. The siren has become something that they are accustomed to. And how heartbreaking is that, really, if you think about it?
Yeah, and some of the people said, especially at that time of night, they just gather the family,
and they go to the bathroom. You know, like if you're preparing for a tornado, like we are always told, go to the bathtub in case of a tornado or something like that, where you can be protected from the shower curtain or whatever. And that's what they do. They said the family gets together in the middle of the night and they just go to a secure room, like a closet or a bathtub, and wait until the sirens are over.
Wow.
Hey, Bo. Hey, Beth.
You know what we do here on Good Morning BT? Bo here and Beth here. And
our phones have been lighting up.
We take your phone calls. We tell you what's going on in the world. News, weather, traffic, sports, politics, entertainment, whatever it is. Whatever people are talking about.
Yeah.
That's what we talk about.
Charlotte's talking about Bo Thompson and Beth Troutman.
Love you guys. I love WBT.
Oh, we love you.
Bo, bringing Beth onto the show was one of the best decisions you ever did.
I wholeheartedly agree.
Wake up with a new sound of Good Morning BT.
This is the best show ever. The best job in the whole world.
Nobody knows Charlotte like Bo and Beth.
Hey, good morning, y'all. I appreciate y'all for being on the air.
Oh, thanks.
This is the Good Morning BT podcast.
Good habits that are actually bad habits. And I wouldn't spend this much time talking about habits, but little did I know last week when we got on this subject about unhealthy habits that actually might surprise you. This thing took off like wildfire.
Yeah.
People calling in about this. And so there's like a follow-up. It's not a follow-up to the... Like, this story was not written in response to that story.
Mm-mm.
But this caught our attention, too, because there are actually a number of habits that you think are good. Like, you're doing because you think it's better for you that actually may be counterproductive.
Yeah, good habits that might be bad for you. I'm just confused at this point. What's good? What's bad? And maybe that's what you're thinking out there. We talked about the first three habits last segment. You stay out of the sun. This article says you need to be in the sun to regulate your circadian rhythms. The other habit, you eat nutrition bars. This article says those are sugar bombs. You need to eat whole foods. You drink only when you're thirsty, that you should be drinking all day long, whether you're thirsty or not, when it comes to your water intake. Habit number four that we haven't gotten to yet, you walk every day for exercise. This one surprised me because I've always heard walking is fantastic for you. And they're not saying that walking is not good for you. You should definitely get out and walk, do 30 minutes of cardio. But this article is saying the thing that we aren't doing is adding strength exercise into that, especially after the age of 40. You need to also put strength exercise in there, lifting weights moderately, building up muscle, because as we age, we lose muscle mass.
So you're supposed to cross train, essentially.
Yeah.
At least a form of cross training.
Yeah. As we age, and I know that I'm guilty of this, as we get older, we think that our bodies can't do some of those exercises and some of those things anymore. Apparently we're wrong, that we can do those things.
Boy, there's a whole nother subject. Okay, so if that's true, you know, you should extend yourself when possible.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, do you have that moment where you do something and immediately realize you shouldn't have done it?
Oh, that you regret it.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear from people on that, actually.
Well, I did it the week before last.
I did, too. What was yours?
My son and he had a friend with them, and we're in the surf at the beach.
Uh-huh,
right.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so they're doing this thing in the surf where they flip in place, like, you know, like a flip when the wave comes up, flip over the wave, but land on your feet. And I used to be able to do that.
But you tried.
Oh, yeah, I tried. That's the funniest part. And I actually sort of pulled it off. When I say that I can't do it anymore, I can't do it the way they did it. I did when I did it. I sort of like in my head, I felt like I looked like the diver with the twist.
Uh-huh.
And then I sort of landed sideways, but I landed like on one foot. It was terribly awful to watch.
Did anyone get video of this? Because
no.
I would love to see how this landed.
But as I speak to you right now, I still feel it.
I still
can feel the muscles that I pulled a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, I tried to do a stationary standing flip. Because I'm so cool and so agile.
And in your brain, you still could do it. Because you used to be able to do it.
My body was reminding me 2 weeks later that I did it. It's basically saying, you moron.
That you tried it.
Yes.
You didn't do it. You tried it.
In my head, I sort of did it. Like one foot landed, but the other one didn't.
See, I did the same thing with my niece not long ago. I was a cheerleader, you know, I took dance classes. I could do like a standing back bend and, you know, Russian jumps and herkies and all that crazy stuff. She has been taking gymnastics and wanted me to do a cartwheel.
Herkies?
Yeah.
So like herky jerky?
Herky. Well, it's
Hercules.
It's a jump where one leg is straight out and one leg is bent back.
Okay.
It's called a herky.
Sorry, I didn't mean
it. But it's like Hercules, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I thought cartwheel, sure, I can absolutely do a cartwheel. I did the cartwheel. And I think the cartwheel might have looked like a cartwheel, but I, like, broke my groin. I mean, like, it just... it hurt.
I'm over here.
Hips.
I know all about broken groins. I now pull my groin doing segments here.
Well, my husband the other day was just loading the dishwasher and threw his back out. Mm-hmm. And I was like, man, how old are we that we, like, at one point you could do a herky and do a back bend, and now you throw your back out when you sneeze.
Now I'm getting messages while I'm doing this segment. Vince, yeah. The visual of you flipping in the surf.
But I think it's the visual of you not landing in the surf is what's best.
The visual of me thinking that I could do this and trying. I'm not kidding you when I'm sitting here right now, and when I make certain jerks, I feel it still. I think it may be going to be with me till the next beach trip.
Yeah, until you try this again. I'm sure there are things out there that everybody has done once we hit 40 that you just still think you can absolutely do. But this, according to this article.
Everything would have been fine if I just would have drank a glass of water after it was over.
Yeah, if you're just not hydrated enough, you need to lubricate. Your joints are dry. I don't even know what that means.
If I only had a heart. All right, well, I oil up here. Let's take a break. It's 9:13 on News Talk 1110 WBT.
We still didn't get to all of them.
That's like a tradition on this show. I mean, it took us an hour to get through one last week.
Exactly.
We're actually doing better, considering. Good morning, BT continues. Tuesday morning.
When a man's an empty kettle, he should be on his mettle, and yet I'm torn apart.
Come on, it was on the
just
platter.
Because I'm presuming that I could be kind of human if I only had a heart.
And if you want to know why I'm playing that,
I'd be tender,
you'll have
be
to go back and listen to the last segment of the podcast.
Regarding love and
all right, so we are having some fun here, and before this segment is over, you know, I say this often. Boy, if you could hear the show off the air.
Yeah.
Just said something a minute ago, and Beth said, no, 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 no.
Nope.
Right?
Yep.
Right? Yep, nope, yep.
Yep, I said nope, and you're saying, I said it emphatically.
You're saying yep to the nope.
I'm saying yes to the nope. Yep to the nope.
But before that, we have one more of the habits that are... people say are good that are actually bad for you.
Yep, yep. It takes us so long to get through these habits. Number five, folks, the last habit that you thought was good that might be bad, you constantly wear supportive shoes. Now, I know that I have so many pairs of tennis shoes, walking shoes. I have orthotics that I put in my shoes that my podiatrist made for me. And apparently, you're not supposed to be doing this all the time. According to this article from AARP, most older adults wear shoes all day, but doing so deprives our feet of a chance to work. Our toes need to push into the ground to maintain balance, and our foot muscles contract to maintain posture.
Your toes need to be out, exposed to the elements, when you can have all those germs accumulate on your foot,
yeah,
as we told you on Friday.
Because you're supposed to be in the dirt. And I have an addendum to this, actually, too. If you ever travel and you are in that phase where you have like jet lag, one of the things you're supposed to do is take off your shoes and stand in the dirt of the place that you are visiting, because the rhythms of the circadian rhythms of the place that you're in will transfer into your body. So walk around barefoot, and you're supposed to alleviate your jet lag.
We are one giant contradiction.
I know.
Here on Friday, we're telling you that the world is going to end because we're wearing flip-flops. And now Beth's saying, wherever you are, just go stand barefooted and squish in the mud.
Exactly. And that's the whole point of all of these habits that are healthy or not healthy. I mean, everything contradicts everything. You know, you hear one day you're supposed to take a multivitamin, and then the next day they're like, there's too much vitamin in that multivitamin. You're like, what? What? What am I supposed to do?
Meanwhile, I'm over here just saying, water is boring.
Now that... I think we can all agree that water is good for us.
But we can all agree water is boring, too, right?
No, I do not agree with that.
Water is, by definition, boring. It has nothing in it.
Water is
It's clear. It has no color. It has no smell. It's boring.
It's the source of life.
Boring doesn't mean bad.
It is also very powerful.
Powerful.
These things can be, a true thing at the same time.
It's cleansing.
Agreed.
It's hydrating. It is fish live in it.
That's why
it's what?
Fish live in it.
That's why you couldn't do the thing in the surf, because you don't have enough water.
Yep. The water was rejecting
or
you.
Or, George, maybe it's because I was standing in the water.
The water rejected you because it knew you hated it.
So we've established today on the show, water is boring and it doesn't like me. Now, you said off the air something that elicited this response. I said something that elicited this response. No, 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 from Beth Troutman. When has she ever said that in this room? When?
Not
ever.
That I could recall, no. Yeah.
It's usually, yes, 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 I want more.
I will try that.
So what was it you said that to? The notion of?
Hot yoga.
No, you said yoga, and then I amped it up and said hot yoga.
Yeah. I'm trying to stretch out my muscles, and I was saying, like, you know what, off the air, I should try. I think I'm thinking about trying Pilates, because I kickbox, and I'm thinking that might be I'm having a lot of impact with kickboxing. Like, maybe I need to do something like Pilates. And then I was like, you know, yoga, I guess I could do yoga. And then you're like, what about hot yoga?
That's what I said. I said, what about hot yoga?
And I said, no, 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 nope.
Now, we say no. This right now, and someone could very possibly be listening to this show while doing yoga.
And I'd be doing hot yoga. It's called vinyasa yoga, right? Is that what it's called, vinyasa yoga?
Don't ask me. I never did it.
I mean,
look, this is what I know about yoga. It's boring like water is to me.
It was a lot of stretching.
A lot of stretching. I know people who have had yoga experiences. I've never gone and done it myself. But I also know that what is hot yoga? So you get a bunch of people in a room and then turn the temperature up, cut the AC off, and then you all sweat together?
Mm-hmm. It's Bikram yoga. That's what it is. It's not vinyasa. It's Bikram.
And
Bikram
then,
yoga.
I'm not going to say where. But there is a place I know, an eating establishment, where it's in the same shopping center as a yoga place. And so it's this weird phenomenon where you'll go eat lunch and you'll be sitting at a booth and people will then walk out of the yoga place.
Just dripping.
Dripping. And they sort of just walk around and they sit, like they'll go sit in a chair, like a public bench. And I'm like, you're getting sweat all over that. And then it's almost like it's... You go in and you do yoga, and then you walk out, and you're there to sort of be on display to all the people eating, like, which makes no sense.
That's I have a very, very sensitive gag reflex, and I just, mm-hmm. I'm just not really interested in being on a mat next to somebody that I'm just watching the stuff drip off their faces and their elbows and their armpits and their feet and their knees. And...
Well, so then kick them out of the room, and then go have a grilled cheese, and then watch them sort of ring out. That's what it is.
See, that's completely unappetizing.
But when did that become acceptable? I don't want to see that. That's what a locker room is for.
I see what you're saying. So, like, you just want them to get, like, go hang out in the shower. Go cold shower it.
Yeah. I don't need to see you post yoga. I don't need to see present yoga either.
Well, I also
am. And for me, there will be no future yoga.
I'm also grumpy. Grumpy, grumpy, grumpy if I get really hot. Like, I get just grumpy. And I don't want to be grumpy while I'm trying to zen myself and do, like, find my center. I don't think I think I just get angry. Like, what, you want me to do the Warrior 2 while I'm watching somebody's armpit hair glisten?
No, 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 no.
Wow, what did I miss?
Oh, you have no idea. Tony, have you ever done yoga before?
Once.
Was it Bikram yoga?
No, it was just regular yoga.
Thank you for not telling me it was hot yoga.
No, no hot yoga, okay. No goat yoga.
Oh, I would do goat yoga.
What?
Oh,
what is goat yoga.
You do it with baby goats, and the baby goats,
they
like,
put a goat
they
on
climb
you.
On you. The goats, like, hang out on you like you're a mountain.
No, 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 no.
Thank you. Thank you, George. There's only one thing worse than goat yoga. Hot goat yoga. All right.
The Weekly Podcast with Beth and Bo.
This was my last. I adore all of you. You are what make people like me and everybody that wants to walk through that door tick. We can't lose it. And I appreciate you all coming. I hope I didn't let you down. I don't remember half of it, but thank you all. All the best. My family, my friends. God, everything you hear about me is true. I'm going downtown with Kid Rock tonight. How about that? Goodbye.
That was Ric Flair last night in Nashville, Tennessee, in what was billed as Ric Flair's last match.
Ric Flair's last match. And thinking about this, I am 45 years old, and my little brother used to love to watch wrestling.
As did I.
So, and I remember watching Ric Flair as a youngster.
Mm-hmm.
So we are talking about a person, a man who performed his last, is it performed? It's performed, right? I can say performed. He didn't compete. He performed in his last match at 73 years old. That's remarkable. I mean, regardless of what you feel about wrestling, that's remarkable because I know in my brain, my body thinks it can still do things, but then I try to do it and my 45-year-old body doesn't do it quite the same. So a 73-year-old body jumping off the ropes and doing the weird, like, what are the triple Nelson or, you know, whatever the what are the moves he's famous for?
Figure four leg lock is his famous one. And the slaps. Against the turnbuckle.
I mean, wearing the little panties. I mean, the little man panties.
Okay. Those are called wrestling trunks, Beth.
Wrestling trunks.
Come on now. I haven't been I was a wrestling fan big time when I was a kid and a young adult, but I haven't followed it much in recent years. But I used to love the Nature Boy, and I saw him perform here in Charlotte many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And if you grew up in Charlotte as a kid, it was hard not to be a wrestling fan because for a while, this is where it was all, at least this, the National Wrestling Alliance, which was run by Jim Crockett. Mm-hmm. And Jim Crockett, his sister was Frances Crockett, who ran the Charlotte O's. But the Crockett family, between minor league baseball and old school Southern wrestling, as a lot of people like to say,
wrestling.
This was a hotbed for it. You could go to the Charlotte Douglas Airport on a Sunday night, you'd see all the wrestlers, the good ones and the bad ones, getting on the plane together because this is where it was all produced out of. Then Ted Turner bought them in the late 90s, and then everything sort of moved to Atlanta and became nationalized and competed with the big bad Vince McMahon from World Wrestling Federation back then and Hulk Hogan and company. But
well, this is the end of an era. I mean, Nikita Koloff used to have a gym over in Concord. There was a place you could work out that you'd see him just hanging out, you know, lifting some kettlebells.
Well, Nikita and Ric Flair, Magnum TA, Ricky Steamboat, Tully Blanchard, the Andersons back in the day. And so the thing with Ric Flair is, though, I mean, Ric Flair is 73 years old. Ric Flair was on life support for 10 days after some issues. He's had heart issues. He's had other things that I won't get into the details of. But the guy almost died several years ago. And if you follow Flair, he was never happy with how he had a final match in the WWE, I believe, with Shawn Michaels, which was supposed to be his send-off. And then what happens with a lot of these guys is they decide they're going to go back at it again. And, you know, there's a payday and you got to make money. And so Ric Flair wrestled four or five times after that, and he was never happy with how the last match went.
How it went.
So he wanted to go back one more time, and he trained for this. And if you followed some of this, I mean, the guy's 73. By the time the thing was over last night, I saw footage of it. He looked like he was about to fall over and, bleeding and all the stuff. And then he says what he says about Kid Rock. I don't doubt that he went out last night. He probably did.
He probably did.
The guy is the hardest living guy. Forget just wrestlers, just period. But I know there were a lot of people close to him that were saying, maybe not so vocally, but thinking to themselves. And some of them were vocal about it, about they weren't so sure this was a good idea because the guy's, you know, he's had health issues. So I think a lot of Ric Flair fans, old school Ric Flair fans, happy to see him go out the way he wants to go out, assuming this is the last match. But also a little part of you now that thinks, gosh, I hope the guy doesn't do, you never know. I mean, he is a 73-year-old in as good a health as a 73-year-old can be in trying to wrestle a match is one thing. A guy who has this much wear and tear on him. Not the thing the doctor would say, hey, great idea.
Yeah, go out there in the ring and do some, what'd you call it, triple leg, quadruple?
Figure four leg
figure
lock.
Figure four leg lock.
Yes.
Figure four leg lock. I mean, to his credit, if you spend your life doing something and you're passionate about it, to go out on your own terms in the way that you want to do it, that's important. I mean, it's his legacy, and he did in that moment seem like he was proud of that performance, of last night's performance. And I bet you he did. I mean, because Kid Rock, I don't know if you saw the videos that went viral of Kid Rock in the audience, you know, drinking his drink and making out with the random lady who was sitting, who was sitting next to him. I guarantee you they went out and maybe threw a couple back.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt. And so if you're keeping score at home, he is 16-time world heavyweight champion. He teamed with his son-in-law last night. This was in Tennessee. And this is the arena where he said that he had, I think, what he thought is his greatest match with Ricky Steamboat back in the day. But this was Ric Flair's last match in Nashville, Tennessee last night. He teamed with his son-in-law, and they fought, or they locked horns with Jeff Jarrett. People may know Jeff Jarrett and Jay Lethal.
And so what's the age difference there? Do you know? Do you actually know how old those other two are?
Let's see. His partner is 32. His son-in-law is 32. Jeff Jarrett's 55. So Jeff Jarrett's not a spring chicken either, but he's...
He's still got it 20 years, yeah, almost 20 years on him.
So, and Jeff Jarrett was a big star in the WWE for a while, too. So anyway, Ric Flair goes out last night. I hope it's his last match.
Yeah, just for his health sake.
73 years old, and he put Jeff Jarrett in the figure four and won the match and then went out and partied with Kid Rock.
At least and his new friend.
Yes, exactly. At least that's what the story on paper says, right?
The best of the week with Bo Thompson and Beth Troutman. Good morning, PT.
Final stretch. News Talk 1110 WBT, Bo Thompson, Beth Troutman. We have Bill Graham, our longtime legal analyst with the law offices of Wallace and Graham, in studio for the whole hour. We get to do that every once in a while, so good to see you.
Always good to be here. The fastest hour in radio.
Yes.
Heard that somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, you were saying during the break we should take calls sometimes.
Yeah.
Maybe we should do it right now. I'm going to bring this call up right here, George. Welcome to News Talk 1110 WBT. Do you have a question for our guest?
Mr. Graham, I've always thought you were just an incredibly brilliant lawyer, and like you, I went to Catawba College, but anyway, I need your help. I got attacked in my car a couple years ago, and I now think I know who it is. Can I, like, sue them or something, and what do you recommend? I mean, I literally attacked in my car by a guy with a big stick.
Was it Ted Budd?
No, wait a minute. I have some audio of this, I think.
Okay, was your vehicle damaged?
Yes. He dented it pretty bad on the roof.
Can you help this caller?
Not this caller. This caller is completely helpless. This caller, oh, by the way, this caller, the school called and you missed English, singer English, so you need to return your diploma.
Hey, man, I had a 2.7 GPA. Leave me alone.
Summer school's available for you. They got a pool and a pond. A pond to be good for you.
Well, I just want to say I enjoyed your show, Mr. Graham. And Beth, you're wonderful. And who's the other guy?
Yeah. So we understand you're a longtime caller, first-time listener, right?
Love you guys.
We love you, Gov.
Gov, you know this person?
Oh, sorry.
I want to know who let this person on the air. Bernie's relatively new. Bernie, you should not have let this caller on.
She was the one that attacked me.
Ah.
It was me.
You know what your problem was, caller?
What?
You were driving a car. Had you been driving a truck like most sane people, you wouldn't have had your roof damaged because the guy was too short with the stick.
Before I leave, can you teach us a new word for our vocabulary?
Humility. How's that for a word for you? You rascal.
Never heard of it.
I know.
Caller,
the other word is ego.
Humble.
I'm piling on. Sorry about that.
Listen, I got to go get a haircut. So,
yes, you do.
I feel like we all just got a haircut in here.
Love you guys.
Chia Pet.
You're doing a great job.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you, caller. We appreciate you, caller, for calling the radio station. All right. Have a great day, caller.
This is the Good Morning BT Podcast. The best of the week with Beth and Bo.
And suddenly... Young Bo is in the den on a Saturday afternoon in the 80s, getting set for, I don't know, it didn't matter who it was, like the Oakland A's versus the California Angels. It was always an American League game that you couldn't see except on the NBC Game of the Week. Bob Costas was the studio host, and then he would toss it to Joe Garagiola and Vin Scully. You hear things Your music just takes you back immediately to a time in your life.
Yeah, that just made me a little bit heartsick, a little bit sad, not only because we lost Vin Scully, but TV music doesn't sound like that anymore. What happened to horn sections in TV music?
You want some more, Beth? You ask and you shall receive. Because this was the World Series theme that they held.
Listen to the brass.
Oh, classic.
And now it's like, are you ready for it? It's all, you know, it's...
or they don't even have it. They just forego it. That's my biggest issue.
Yeah.
So this was the game of the week on NBC. We're talking about the legacy of Vin Scully. I think a lot of people would say he's the greatest play-by-play guy ever.
Well, I think he set the standard.
Yeah. I mean, I know that that's arguable for some, but he's on the Mount Rushmore, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about just a guy who could do everything, but at the end of the day, he was the voice of the Brooklyn and then the L.A. Dodgers. He did it for 67 years for one team. And then he was so good, they got him for other things, too. Like, he did the Masters, and he did, like I said, NBC, and he did, NFL. He could go on and on, but he was... the guy was, 94 years old, Vin Scully? So he retired as the voice of the Dodgers in 2016, and we knew that his days were... He's getting up there. I mean, mm-hmm. a life well-lived.
Yeah, I mean, 88 to be the age where you finally, hang up that sport coat and put that microphone away for the last time. That's quite a life and quite a life well lived and quite a life that was impactful to so many people, not just sports fans, but just people who were interested in broadcasting or people who were just interested in seeing a kind, classy person on the air communicating about what was going on.
Now, you say 88 years old when he hung things up. When I hear Vin Scully, I think of 88, too, but it's not because of how old he was then. It's because of 1988.
And look who's coming up. The demands until he was physically unable to start tonight with two bad legs, the bad left hamstring and the swollen right knee. And with two out, you talk about a roll of the dice. This is it. If he hits the ball on the ground, I would imagine he would be running 50% to first base. So the Dodgers trying to catch lightning right now. Sacks waiting on deck, but the game right now is at the plate. High fly ball into right field. She is gone!
Oh, man, I'll never, ever forget that. And that's one of those unique moments. So that was immortalized by Vin Scully on NBC. That was the TV call.
Were you watching that live?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Dennis Eckersley, and that was the Oakland A's when they had Mark McGwire, when this is well before the steroid scandal. They had Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire and Dave Stewart, and I can name the whole team. And then Kirk Gibson, what was it, pinch hitting right there. And he had both ankles injured, so he could barely walk. Like, you know how you favor one when one – he had to favor both. So he gets up there and wins the game. A lot of people think that was the winning game of the World Series. It wasn't. It was game one. They actually won. The Dodgers did later on, several games later. But that was, I think that's the most iconic moment at Dodger Stadium, L.A. Dodger Stadium. But Kirk Gibson. And so when I talk about people like Vin Scully, and I talk about growing up with the Braves announcers like Pete Van Wehren and Skip Carey, Marv Albert, I love Marv Albert on NBC. Is there somebody some voice that you heard?
Well, I mean, it was two voices that I heard and faces that I saw that as a young person, I thought, I think maybe I want to do that at some point. But Barbara Walters mm-hmm. and Diane Sawyer, those two kind of represented what I hoped I could be, when I was a little girl. And in fact, when I was a senior in high school, I had to make a speech about what I wanted life to be. And at this point, I wasn't I had no, you know, I'm 45 and I can look back and I actually did some of these things, but I ended my speech by saying, and one day you will hear me say, I'm Beth Troutman and this is 2020. I never said that. I haven't gotten to say that.
Well, now you could say, I'm Beth Troutman and it's 2022.
Exactly. Right? There you go.
Well, look, I wondered who it was because I don't think I've ever asked you that before, but that's a great answer. And she's iconic as well, just in the same vein in broadcasting as Vin Scully is. We're going to end today, if it's okay with you. Can I be a little bit selfish here and end with a little bit of Vin Scully going out?
That's not being selfish. We should be honoring him today.
Well, this is a little piece here. I can't play the whole thing, but this is the final piece of his final moments on the air back in 2016.
People have wished me congratulations on a 67-year career in baseball, and they've wished me a wonderful retirement with my family. And now all I can do is tell you what I wish for you. May God give you for every storm a rainbow, for every tear a smile, for every care a promise, and a blessing in each trial. For every problem life seems a faithful friend to share, for every sigh a sweet song, and an answer for each prayer. You and I have been friends for a long time, but I know in my heart that I've always needed you more than you've ever needed me. And I'll miss our time together more than I can say. But you know what? There will be a new day and eventually a new year. And when the upcoming winter gives way to spring, rest assured, once again, it will be time for Dodger baseball. So this is Vin Scully wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon wherever you may be.
This has been the Good Morning BT Weekly Podcast. Hear Bo Thompson and Beth Troutman live weekday mornings 6 to 10 on News Talk 1110 and 99.3 WBT and worldwide on the WBT mobile app.